Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Hey guys, this is Terry with a quick note. Just wanted to apologize for some technical difficulties that made McAneer's audio on this podcast a little bit choppy. We hope to have isolated the problem and figured it out to avoid it in the future. But for this instance, we decided that it wasn't too disruptive to the point where this podcast wasn't salvageable. So apologize for any words that might have been cut out throughout, but hopefully you find it listenable and the conversation worthwhile. And we'll be back next week with more Inside Lacrosse Podcasts.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined today by Inside Lacrosse Editor-in-Chief Matt Kinnear. And Matt, we're kind of, I don't know, we're flirting with the idea of making this type of conversation a little bit more regular and calling it The Source. We did it a little bit when we spoke earlier in the week to Hallie about the conversation around whether or not there's going to be a college season in 2021. So if you haven't listened to that, go back and check it out. But we're ending the week with a little bit of a different conversation, this one about a really surprising and in some respects interesting arc that has unfolded in the world of journalism and touched the world of lacrosse and inside lacrosse directly over the course of the last month. But before we dive into it, how are you doing?
It's, obviously been a weird week. Election stuff has kind of been wall to wall. You know, here at Inside the Cross, we're in that, you know, we're prepping. We are looking ahead at, say, the next 6 months. You know, I think last week's discussion that we had is kind of, a little representative of the conversation we're having in terms of, like, you know, how do we prepare as an editorial staff for a little bit of the unknown? So that's daunting and a little scary in a lot of different ways, but it's good. I'm pumped to discuss this article that we're going to talk about, and I'm pumped to maybe had this idea for a little while now, just kind of what is this question about the topics that are facing the sport? You know, how can we kind of share our process a little more with the readers, with the listeners, peel back the curtain on Inside the Cross, and make it something fun, informative for the listeners?
Sure. Well, you mentioned it. We're going to talk about the mad world of niche sports recruiting, which appeared in the Atlantic, the November issue of the magazine. It was written by Ruth Shallett Barrett. I am quoted in it in my capacity as the CEO of Inside Lacrosse, and I candidly spoke to the reporter multiple times dating back through to March of 2020 as she worked on this story and, you know, developed a pretty open dialogue with her. And that has continued kind of up through the publishing of the story and the immediate reaction to it. I first wanted to start by just addressing my quote. As I said, the original conversations began in March when she and I were connected through another source, a prominent former club director who referred her to me and just said, I think this is the type of person that you'd have interest in talking to. She's writing a story. It was interesting and funny in making this connection. The individual said for the Athletic, which it turns out is a pretty consistent misintroduction that occurred in terms of her source network providing interviews to her, realizing that there's obviously a substantial distinction between the Athletic and the Atlantic. That being said, it was exciting to talk to someone who was planning to write about lacrosse in whatever context for the Atlantic. And when she explained the story pitch, it really was mostly the story that came to fruition. I would say the biggest distinction between the story I thought she was writing versus the story that I eventually read was how Fairfield County centric it was. When we talked about the, we had the conversation initially, I thought it was much more national in scope and really focused on what has been a, you know, often discussed. There was actually another article in the Atlantic in 2018 that Matt, you shared with me this morning as we were preparing for this podcast that essentially called niche sports affirmative action for rich white kids. And when I say essentially, that was basically exactly the headline. So it wasn't as if the topic that we were going to discuss was, you know, something that hadn't been covered in the past. But, and she asked my point of view on the landscape writ large, and the way I interpret it is the idea of how do you utilize a sport, your participation in a sport, in order to get into a school whose academic profile is maybe a rung higher than what you would have been able to get into strictly on the basis of your own high school academic merit, your grades and your SAT scores and the other things along those lines. And so that was the context through which we had this conversation, and we talked about the development of this industry surrounding club lacrosse and kind of the, you know, pay to develop opportunities that persist in the sport. And I shared my thoughts, and I think it would be fair to say that everybody inside lacrosse is pretty familiar with that world. And then obviously the story got significantly sidetracked, as pretty much everything did, by COVID, and it got shelved. And so when the opportunity to have it published emerged as the time slot that it ultimately filled, publishing online in mid-October and in print in the November issue, the story needed an update concerning COVID. And she reached out to me to inquire what I thought the outcome of COVID was going to mean for this particular idea, right? And keep in mind, like, the story is about athletes utilizing their prowess in their sport as a means toward advancing their academic destination. And what I said was, it appears that obviously Ivy League accepted, because of the fact that the Ivy League, by and large, has rules that prevent athletes from coming back for an additional year, utilizing that additional year of eligibility that the NCAA awarded spring sport athletes on March 30th, accepting the Ivy League, and most institutions were going to essentially have about 4.5 grades worth of players on their roster. And so when it comes to recruiting specifically for the class of 2021, this year's high school seniors, there was probably going to be some compression at the top in terms of the number of players they were going to bring in from that grad year relative to normal. And the point I tried to make was that as a result of that compression, if a normal incoming class had 12 players in it, perhaps the class of 2021 would only have 10 players. Well, then that means that there are two players who would have had an opportunity to go to that, you know, highest rung academic institution, and then potentially they choose to go to, you know, a consideration just below that. And that trickle-down effect has a continuous kind of slope, so to speak, that ultimately will probably result in some high school seniors who would have played college lacrosse in another year saying, it is not worth it for me. Eventually it gets to a point where you are going to play college lacrosse is probably a academic downgrade, so to speak, compared to what you would be able to get into on your own merit. There is like a tipping point there that occurs. And so in illustrating this point, I evoked a couple of schools by name just to make it clearer, but it wasn't the point. The point wasn't to make a comparison between one school, another school, a third school, and a fourth school. The point is to say that when the overall, you know, say for instance, there's 15 to 20 of the 74 men's Division I programs that high school lacrosse players target to try to go to increase their academic landing spot relative to what they'd be able to get into on their own accord or of their own, you know, kind of academic setting coming out of high school. And then there's, you know, so that's a Division I level, and then there's roughly an equivalent number at the Division III level. Well, obviously there's a perishable number of spots, and if that overall pool shrinks, then you're looking at, you know, a couple dozen to maybe several dozen potential college lacrosse players who are going to choose to not play college lacrosse and go to an institution that they were able to get into on the basis of their academic standing. And so that was the point I was trying to make, and she editorialized to some extent by referring to my comment as mournfully, which our colleague Kyle Devitt evoked in his newsletter as something that he's never seen me be mournful. And whether or not I was mournful when I said it is not for me to decide. That's in the ear of the interpreter. But I will say that I am sympathetic to those college players who in a normal year would have played, or I'm sorry, those high school seniors who in a normal year would have played college lacrosse that this year probably won't. I just wanted to address that off the top, kind of like as a disclosure. It's not what the bulk of this conversation is going to be about. And I wanted to include Matt in this conversation because of the two of us, he is the more classically trained journalist who worked for a daily newspaper prior to coming to Inside Lacrosse. And so as we open up the scope of this conversation to talk about the subsequent fallout, Matt is better served to kind of put into context how what's happened correlates with the standards that you're taught. So Matt, can you just kind of describe the events that have unfolded since this was published in The Atlantic as you understand them, and we can talk a little bit about what it actually means for the piece in total?
Yeah, sure. Well, I guess I'll start with, mentioned I'm more of the classically trained. Let me just kind of set the table there in terms of, you know, I went to the University of Maryland. I went to the Philip Merrill College of Journalism at Maryland. It's a, you know, pretty high regarded journalism school. You know, there's not a lot of just specific journalism schools, but that's one, you know, in my background. And, you know, something that I just, you know, I wouldn't say I grew up, you know, with this passion for journalism, but I think people, I grew up reading the newspaper at the breakfast table, and it appealed to me because I kind of, and this is something I want to talk about later, it appealed to me because I thought it was like more of the blue collar of the kind of academic, you know, liberal art. So that's kind of really what drew me into it. You know, there's a very high standard of accuracy, fairness, and obviously plagiarism is something that is just nailed into your head from day one that if you do this, then, you know, you are persona non grata in this field. You do not belong here. So I think the way to kind of start with this is the, you know, with the writer herself, you know, Ruth Shalit Barrett, or, you know, I think the byline originally, I believe, only had Ruth Barrett on it, and they added Ruth Shalit Barrett to kind of make it more clear who the writer was. You know, she has a little bit of a spotted history with, you know, she was kind of in this world of, you know, I want to say elite journalism, you know, elite magazine journalism, you know, writing these feature stories for, you know, real and publication. New Republic was where, you know, she kind of got into some trouble with plagiarism, you know, back in the 90s. So this is kind of her, you know, second chance, you know, this story. She's had some pieces that have been published since then. And this is kind of a big story that, you know, from everything that I've read from The Atlantic, they've said that, you know, she has kind of gotten back to a point where her reputation has been proven, where we felt comfortable giving her this story. Then the story comes out, you know, it's extremely well read. I think at first people, you know, the content of the story kind of was what people latched onto, you know, the parents in the story and kind of some of the, like, for lack of a better term, crazy things that they're doing with their kids. Of the lacrosse, you know, the cost of the club landscape was something that people really had a strong reaction to. That kind of the content of the story, the points that I think she wanted to get across, were the things that people talked about for, I'd say, the first few days to a week after the story came out. Then I thought you kind of started to see people poke holes. You know, there's the comment about the Olympic size ice rink in the backyard. You know, if anyone knows, you know, I played hockey, an Olympic size ice rink is enormous. So people were like, that doesn't make any sense. Who is that in their backyard? There's the comment about the 80th or 90th best midfielder and them going to Bates. And people were like, that doesn't make any sense. And then there's just kind of, you know, when people started to poke holes at some of the specific subjects in the story, you know, you notice that one of the main subjects of it talks about having a son. They don't, that's, you start to question, and then you go down, you know, we're going to say this term rabbit hole again. We used that last week on the podcast a lot, but then, you know, as a fact checker, as someone who's looking into the story, the Washington Post, Eric Wemple is a media, a lot of this digging, you start going down that hole, and then you kind of realize that, all right, so the sun doesn't exist. What else in this story is either stretching the truth, is a complete fabrication, is, you know, just something that is just flat out, you know. And then I think what it's kind of come down to be is, you know, one of the sources, particularly the one who didn't have a son, you know, there's a thought that maybe the writer and that source, you know, the writer maybe coerced the source to say, hey, when the fact checker calls, Here's a few more details that I kind of added to your story that will juice it up a little bit. So it seems I'm going to it there, but when it relates to the story, there's probably a lot of content in it that is, you know, substantive. Like the point probably exists in some way, but you know, when you look at like this is kind of another chapter of the Princeton story from, you know, that is referenced within this story, you know, this kind of has better anecdotes, has better, more flashier subject matter. You know, the story about the girl fencing and, you know, I think it was a 4th of July massacre. You know, that is just something that draws people, gets more attention. It turns out that a lot of that was fabrication or at least stretching the truth, which gets us to the point we're at now of, you know, when you have those things and you can poke holes in it, whether the substance of your story matters or not, like whether the substance of your story is true or not, whether the point is true, at this point, it doesn't matter because you have ruined your reputation. Everything, every word that you write in the story is essentially meaningless because of that.
Yeah. So I think the way that I would frame it is that once it is proven that there are aspects of the story that are untrue or embellished, then everything else will be questioned as a result. And it means that the credibility of the piece is undermined to the extent that the impact that it has is obviously comparatively limited relative to if the credibility is completely unimpeached. And I think that that's where the Atlantic editors felt the need to both inform the audience. Obviously, you mentioned the increased transparency that comes from editing the byline, as well as some of the specific anecdotes that have been pointed out. You're right to start with the Olympic-sized hockey rink as a fact that was not, you know, kind of borne out, so to speak. I did want to address the line about the 80th best midfielder ending up at Bates College, because that was actually something that I spoke to the fact checker at the Atlantic about twice. And I do believe that it was born out of some version of a conversation that I had had with the writer during the reporting process. But when the fact checker read it to me initially, I had the same reaction as Casey DeNolfo shared with the Washington Post, which is, no, the 80th best midfielder in the country goes to, say, the 30th best Division I program, right? If every class is bringing in three midfielders, or every team is bringing in three midfielders in a class, you know, you do the quick math, and that's roughly where the 80th best midfielder is going to shape up. But then the way that the fact checker reframed it for me was, well, keep in mind that we're only talking about the percentage of the population of lacrosse players that are looking at it through the lens of going to an elite academic institution. To which point I then said the math that I shared earlier with respect to how many Division I programs fall into that category, right? And I think we can all kind of loosely agree it's somewhere around 20. And then, you know, obviously Bates being in the NESCAC and having been a top 10 program multiple times over the last 5 years at least, I'm like, oh, okay, well then in that context, like, I suppose it is a little bit more reasonable in terms of the way that the math shakes out. Like, you know, Bates might be a top 30 program with respect to the college lacrosse men's teams where you are using lacrosse to get into a better school than you otherwise would, right? So that's kind of where I left it with the fact checker that I think that qualifier needs to be clear, and ultimately it wasn't. I think that's where there was some available space to criticize that particular line, which the Washington Post did, as you know, and cited Tufts coach Casey DeNolfo in terms of why and how anybody would read that line that way. But specifically, that, you know, it just kind of falls into the category of like another disclosure that I feel compelled to make in terms of the topic of the conversation. But circling all the way back around to the piece itself, and the fact that, like I said, you know, there had been other publications who had written similar stories. But Matt, to your point, one of the reasons this particular piece got so much attention is because the anecdotes that illustrated the lengths to which folks go to allocate resources and invest time in their child's athletic development for this specific and particular goal was obviously one of the reasons that this piece got so much attention. And one of your immediate reactions when you read this is, that won't be me as a parent. I don't have kids. So once again, you're in a position of firsthand experience that informs and allows you to speak to it better than I can. How do you characterize your reaction gutturally, emotionally reading the piece? And how do you square it with kind of the lacrosse landscape that obviously you know very, very well and intimately?
You know, well, I think, like, to qualify it, you know, the parents that are specifically talked about, you know, some of the parents, you know, particularly the first anecdote that are talked about in this story, you know, my reaction was, like you said, that's not going to be me. And more acutely, you know, these people are fulfilling their own dreams and desires, and they are putting their ego and their own need for reassurance, validation ahead of their kids' dreams, ahead of their kids' just day-to-day fun, you know, ahead of their kids' just lives, essentially. You know, so I was pretty angry, you know, reading some of these parents, and, you know, the kids aren't talked to, so there could be maybe these kids just absolutely love it and I'm wrong. But, you know, the impression that I got reading these stories, and the parents even, you know, in some of these cases kind of came back to it and said, what am I doing? You know, this wasn't to make your kids' life better. I know the end goal is a very justifiable one in terms of, I want my kid to be in the best position possible to get the best education, to have the best academic and athletic and social experience possible. But, you know, it somehow got bastardized from the parents that are talked about in the story. And it went from doing what's best for my kid to doing A, what I think is best for my kid, and B, and more, you know, sad, is what is going to sound best when I am talking to my peers, you know, in this kind of circle of people that is, you know, an extremely well-to-do, you know, and accomplished, and, you know, people who have done a lot for themselves. You know, that really struck me as, like, you're not being a good parent in this. You are doing something for yourself. You're not doing it for your kids. This quote, and I wanted to pull this quote out. And again, this is kind of odd to talk about, because now it's, you know, you're talking about my gut reaction. There's the aspect of it of things that maybe, you know, some of these quotes maybe aren't even true. You know, maybe they're fabricated, maybe they're fiction. But this quote that came out of this, the, you know, the penalty that they're using athletics to escape, quote, the penalty that comes from being from an advantage zip code. And she continued, but who you are is not enough. It might be enough in Kansas, but not here. That one really struck me. And then there's a water polo parent that says, what parent wants to have a child who's going to be playing for a bottom tier school with bottom tier academics in the armpit of the United States? I want to be polite, but there's no way in hell. You know, like, that's just an out of touch person.
Right.
That I know you want what's best for your kid. You know, maybe your kid, you know, can't handle it academically. Maybe the anxiety that you're putting on is going to hurt them. Maybe they're just on moment in their life as a high schooler that they need to have. Maybe they just need to have Saturday. They drive around the mall, and, you know, like, this, you know, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe, you know, maybe when my kid older, my kid, you know, I have a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old. Maybe when they, maybe I'll kind of get put in place a little bit and my mind will change. I really hope not. But this comes down to is people who care more about their people than and not caring what their kid wants. And, you know, maybe going to school that's not your MSCAP is the your kid. Maybe you've had the conversation with your kid and your kid is like, hey, it's only going to be Yale or Harvard for me. Be sure that I'm going to do whatever it takes. That's, but I didn't get the pressure whatsoever.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of wisdom in there, and I think there's also a lot of humility in the sense that I think it's important for you to acknowledge that you don't know how the future is going to unfold for you and for your family. And I think that that's one of the themes that you can pull away from this, which is there are a lot of families who it almost got out of control, right? And it wasn't as if mm-hmm. there's no culpability, but if it's a pot boiling, if you dropped a family into the experiences that they had trying to chase this goal at the outset, they would have said, no, that's foolish. But as an incremental increase, it's easier to imagine it could happen. And I think that that is, you know, to the extent that this is not being read exclusively in a way of gawking and more so in a way of, all right, I understand that this is the extreme end of the spectrum, but that there's a lot of middle ground between me and them. And yet some of that middle ground is common ground. And I understand, and you know, it forces me to reconsider some of the choices that I've made as a parent for my family and to try to help my kid achieve his or her goals. I thought that was another interesting thing. And this is where, to circle back around to the notion of being excited about the opportunity to talk about lacrosse for a story that's going to appear in the Atlantic, I received more feedback about being quoted in this story from people in my, like my friends and family, than, you know, almost anything I've ever done because of the way in which it penetrated the mainstream. And, you know, somebody in my social network who otherwise wouldn't have seen this story except for the fact that it appeared in the Atlantic reached out and said, you know, shared the normal reaction of this is so absurd, but then ended with, I think, what was a relatively familiar refrain, which is, oh yeah, and I just spent $2,500 on fall soccer tuition. And it was just like, yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, that's where we all kind of have to confront, where does this fit in terms of our value structure? How are we, you know, allotting resources and making choices that are appropriate for our family? And I think that the difference is when you go to the extreme in terms of resource allocation, you know, $20,000 doesn't mean the same to every family on the basis of what they earn. So I don't know. I'm not trying to be sympathetic. I'm just trying to be, or at least overly sympathetic. I'm just trying to like contextualize the fact that, you know, one of the reasons that this story was so salacious and so entertaining is because the reality that exists in that part of the world is so foreign to the reality that exists in so many other parts of the world. And this was a glimpse into that, that otherwise a lot of people wouldn't necessarily have or wouldn't have had.
Yeah. And Terry, to kind of build on that, you know, with our experience with, we interact with a good amount of lacrosse parents. The majority of them are not this person. There are, like, you know, I've been talking to a parent, you know, at a sideline at our event. And, you know, if you kind of know their background, know who they are, it's almost like kind of inspiring, like, oh my gosh, this person, like, you know, could buy my house six times over. You know, like there's some very wealthy people in our poor. It doesn't mean that they're bad people. In fact, I would say most of the time, there's a level of humility from these parents and they love to be out here playing, not playing, be out here with my kid while they're playing lacrosse, be out on the circuit. I would say most people kind of come out the other side of this summer club, recruiting circuit, whatever you call it, have a good experience in the sense that, like, you know, for this stretch of years, my son or daughter, like I got to, it was crazy, but, you know, there's the parenting saying that like the days go slow, but the years go fast.
Yeah.
The, you know, I got to, it was crazy at the time. It was hectic. I was stressed out all the time. It cost us a ton of money, but you know what? Like for all these weekends in the summer, in a hotel room with my son or daughter and got to watch them play and, you know, have those dinners at Chili's and like talk to them and know them. Get to that is the, like, that's the joy and that's the fun that this sport, and you know, I would imagine, not too familiar with these other sports named, but just sports in general offer, and particularly like when you're playing it at a high level and you know there's kind of something at the end of it too, whether it's getting a college scholarship or just the elite, the excitement that comes for playing for championships in the summer. You know, getting to see your name and inside the cross, like that's all awesome stuff. So, you know, from the majority of people that we interact with, you know, like summer sports is like stressful and it's difficult and it's expensive, but it really is awesome. The parents and the people that are just, you know, I wouldn't say are, they are a slice of the parents, and we have dealt with some of those, you know, anecdotally, when something like recruiting ranking comes out, that brings out some to, you know, they'll say like, if my kid knew I was calling you, they would hate me. But I want to tell you, that happens. That happens more than I think people would think. So there are people who have just a little bit of view that I would say is just, you know, not for their kids, but for themselves. But that's definitely not the general parent population. And if you want to kind of speak to like the journalism side of this, this is kind of just a question of Terry, does this reflect like, you know, these anecdotes, the parents that are talked about in the story, does this accurately, you know, is this a depiction of a slice of life of a certain kind of parent that is worth exploring and delving into? Or is the writer trying to make it, you know, I'm using these handful of parents, these handful of anecdotes, relating it to something bigger that it isn't. And, you know, the way that some of the more salacious stories have been, you know, the 4th of July massacre one that I mentioned, like there was two tournaments that the father and the mother were in with their different kids, different parts of the country. And it turns out that, you know, they weren't even on the same weekend, you know, right. Like that was kind of a shift to make it sound more extreme. But it's the whole story, you know, I'm going to use these parents, the very tip of the iceberg in terms of, you know, the ones who were doing the quote craziest things, spending the most, you know, having an outlook that is the most out of touch with the reality. And I'm going to use it to maybe paint a picture of a audience that shouldn't be a picture painted about them.
So there were a handful of things in there that you mentioned that you want to touch on. The notion of the days go slow, but the years go fast is one that I think is worthy of getting highlighted, particularly because the way that, you know, I encountered a handful of people reacting to this story and criticism of the choices that were being made in it is, you know, one that stuck with me. I read a comment that it was like, I am so glad I'm done with that part of my life, but I'm so jealous of all of you who are going through it right now. I thought that was a really interesting way to frame it in as well, because the point that you're making is true, right? Like, and that's where I think that the question that always needs to be answered is, are you having fun? Are you enjoying it? It is certainly most important that that's true for the child, but it's also true for the family. It's also true for the parents. If you as a parent aren't enjoying it, then, you know, I can understand the compulsion to provide your kid with the experience, even if you're like, oh, I hate this, but your kid enjoys it and your kid wants it. Well, that's a tough spot to be in. I can get that. But I'd probably advise to say no and figure out an alternative. That's what my parents did with me, and it forced me to figure out an alternative. So I don't know. That's just the comment that I would make there. Participating in this ecosystem really comes down to, you have to want to do it. I think that's really important. But then to the question you raised about, is this an accurate representation? You know, I think that that's very much in the eye of the beholder. And, you know, for me, we share an office with Tommy Lyons, who's a Darien High School lacrosse player, and my experience getting to know him and his family does not fit into this story. You know what I mean? So there will always be exceptions, even when you try to make it about geography or culture or something like that. You know, there are always going to be counter examples that might be more numerous and might be considerably more numerous. Doesn't necessarily invalidate the legitimacy of that minority, and particularly when they're especially interesting, which ultimately is what this story was and why it was so, you know, well read, even before all of the issues with it arose.
Yeah, so to get into the journalism discussion and kind of a little bit of you know, to get back to the journalism discussion and, you know, a little that I just kind of already brought up of like, you know, it's tough because you find a story that as the writer, you think is symbolic of something bigger. That's, you know, because it's not, there's, you know, I feel like I talk, so I apologize, like just keep bringing up these old cliches, but you know, like there's the show don't tell, you know, you don't want to say, it's not interesting to a reader to say X is what happened. You need to find an example of X happening and share them. You know, that's what good storytelling is, but there's a limit to that because, you know, one person doing X, but that doesn't mean that that whole population that you're talking about is also doing it. So, you know, I can see how like these stories and you get them and you're like, this is like, these are really interesting, you know, stories that really shed light on what's going on in this. It's not really like, it's tough to say, but then the fact that you add on the fact that, you know, I needed to juice up these stories by adding details that whatever I thought significant or what, I don't know, I can't get into her head, but the fact that you had to add these anecdotes or these supplements to these anecdotes, you know, whether it's adding a kid or changing the date of an event, calling a, you know, small laceration on the neck a massacre, then you start to wonder, did the writer have an idea in mind of what she thought the story should be? And she shaped the reporting to be that story as opposed to letting the story be what it was.
Well, I think that's a good lingering question to kind of end on. As we mentioned at the top, we're going to try to do this with some frequency between now and the beginning of the season and add some segments to the end of the podcast. One is a look at what you might have missed on Inside Lacrosse recently. Matt, is there anything that jumped out to you? You've produced most of it, so is there any recommendation that you would have on the basis of what someone might have missed in the over the course of the last week on InsideLacrosse.com?
Well, I will try to steer clear of my own work and highlight some of the others, but you know that there's a story about Mallory Hasselbeck, the number one senior in the girls' 21. And you may be very well familiar with that name, Matt Hasselbeck, the famed quarterback out of Boston College. He is her dad, and he is very much a part of the story. And as is her sister, and her sister is a great player, I believe, in the 2020 class.
That's right.
That is right. Okay. So, you know, read up on that. And it's funny because, like, reading the story, obviously Matt Hasselbeck and Sarah Hasselbeck, you know, they're athletes. They're both athletes. Of course, their kids are going to be super athletic, but it's really a fun, it's really just like about two parents and their kids fell into lacrosse and found lacrosse and loved lacrosse, which is a story that you don't need to be Matt How, you don't need to be a former NFL quarterback to appreciate, you know, like you don't, it's not the fact that Matt Hasselbeck is the father. It is kind of a story about this is the way that a lot of people find the game and fall in love with the game. It just happens to be that pretty famous match to them. So read it for the quotes from Matt Hasselbeck, but also take out the lesson that, you know, this is a story across the country of people finding the game.
What I will recommend is Stephen Stamp's Musing from Thursday, which was about where the 2020 NLL draft picks hailed from. It's a particularly unique year because of the amount of high-end draft prospects that chose to go back to play college lacrosse for their final year of eligibility, and obviously the projected number one overall pick, Jeff Teat, is the most significant among those, but he was not the only one, and as a result, there were more players selected from relatively unusual feeder programs compared to years past. But I also think it's an interesting story to read with an eye toward the future in terms of as box lacrosse has been positioned more and more as a helpful tool to become better at a complementary way to get better at field lacrosse, the number of players, the number of NCAA players from Canada, and the number of NCAA players who played summer box, and the way in which that continues to evolve, particularly with the Collegiate Box Lacrosse League in Colorado first, and then more recently in Ohio, and I believe there's plans to be a part of that affiliation in Connecticut with their Box Lacrosse League that I think has been running the last 2 years as well going forward. It is just kind of an interesting table set for what was otherwise a very unusual draft, and definitely worth taking a look at. And the other segment, Matt, is just kind of a teaser for what to be on the lookout coming down the pipeline. What would you recommend make sure that folks keep an eye out for?
Well, first of all, Terry, I think we should make one of the topics of this just about box lacrosse and more of a future of box lacrosse, future of NLL from more of a business-centric focus, because I think there's a lot of fascinating things to unpack there. So let's save that as a topic for another day. The NLL season is going to be starting in April this year, for people who didn't notice that this past week. But one thing I want to bring up, and, you know, I kind of want to share the space for maybe stuff that, like, we're having conversations with. They're not at, you know, whether it's an interesting project we have at Inside the Cross, or just, like, there's some stories bubbling up that we're not quite, like, at this, like, you know, I'm reporting this fact.
Right, kind of level. We don't know that, you know, this is going to post on the site next week.
Right, but mid-year transfers, that's one thing that I think people should keep an eye on. You know, we're getting closer to, maybe I'm being a little bit premature here, but we're getting closer to the holidays. We're getting closer to the point where either the fall semester is going to stop and student athletes who are working remotely from their homes are just, you know, done with their classes, or, you know, student athletes who are at institutions are going back home to their families. You know, I've had a coach speculate that there's going to be an increase in the number of mid-year transfers, just something to keep a lookout when we get to kind of this holiday season. You know, the kind of reasoning behind that was, you know, I'm going to a college and I thought I was going to have this kind of college experience. COVID has derailed that to some extent, and that obviously wildly differs by what your institution's rules are, what you're allowed to do on campus. Are you going to classes? Are you remote? All of those things. But the coach kind of speculated that there might be a lot of people who opt to just kind of stay home and go to their, you know, backyard institution, or maybe take a spring and figure out what they're going to do. So just kind of keep a lookout for an influx of mid-year transfers. I don't know if it'll happen, but it's worth exploring and checking that transfer portal for.
The story that I'm going to have to do more work on as soon as I possibly can, because I do think there is some urgency behind it, but it's been developing over the course of the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks, first out of Michigan and then more recently out of Virginia, is adjusted rules for the high school season, particularly around face-offs and whether or not, in an effort to prevent the further spread of COVID, rules are being adopted that turn boys lacrosse into an alternating possession game after goals, when the original document from Michigan emerged on social media, there wasn't a ton of clarity as to where this fell relative to it's going to happen versus it might happen versus it's something that somebody recommended as a possibility for what could happen. But now that a second state has, and this is the part that I need to close the loop on, posited it as a recommendation, that's where I'm wondering how likely is it that a significant change to the playing rules in an effort to reduce the spread of COVID-19 is possible for the 2021 high school season. And if it does appear like some substantial change is going to occur, what it entails, what that means for, you know, the players in that state and everything along those lines. So that's something that I'm going to take a look at and hopefully put something together on as soon as possible.
And Cross has recently weighed in on that as well, about the conversation of Cross or not, you know, in terms of COVID. So there's a lot there of it affecting, obviously, geographically a large part of the country, you know, if this kind of idea of the spread, but also, you know, how the governing body used it as well.
All right, well, Matt, I think that'll do it for this edition of the Inside Lacrosse podcast. Thank you for your time. If you liked what you heard, leave a rating and review. Tell a friend. Hit us up on social media. He's at Matt Kinnear. I'm at Terrence Foy on Twitter. And we'll be back next week with more Inside Lacrosse podcasts.
Inside Lacrosse podcasts, the source of the sport.